This is a podcast from Camden Community Radio.
For more information and to volunteer,
email info@ccradio.org.
You are listening to Camden Community Radio with me, Bonnie. This podcast is about a workshop series that I participated in at Mind in Camden, a local mental health charity, in October 2017. The workshop series was on the philosophy of mind, and it was created and facilitated by Sophie Stammers, a philosopher at the University of Birmingham. The aim was to critically discuss ideas and models of mental health using philosophical tools and the personal experiences of group members. It was a real success, and we all got a lot out of the group discussions. We've kept in touch, and 1 year later, we've met up to talk about the workshop series, reflect on our experiences, and share them with others. All of the materials that Sophie used for the workshop series are online, so if you like what you hear, you can go online and access the materials yourself. There are links to the resources in the show notes and at the end of this episode. So I'm going to start by asking Sophie to tell me a bit more about the workshop series, and then we'll move on to the group discussion.
Yeah, I'm a philosopher at the University of Birmingham working on a project with a number of other philosophers and psychologists. We're funded by the European Research Council, and we look into the strengths and limitations of cognition. So cognitions, things like beliefs or memories or even the way we explain our behaviour or plan our behaviour or make judgments. And we look at the ways that these things get conceptualised and then evaluated. So something we're interested in is the idea of irrationality and how that idea gets used, particularly to characterise cognition in mental health contexts. And one thing we're interested in exploring is looking at instances of irrationality and otherwise unusual cognition outside of mental health contexts and saying, actually, look, there's quite a lot of similarities here, and maybe the way that we use irrationality to characterise things in mental health cases, you know, perhaps can be questioned. So that's part of what we're doing on the project. We're also interested in exploring whether there are any underexplored benefits to unusual experiences, cognitions and beliefs. And that's kind of really where the inspiration for the philosophy workshop series happened. The idea of the workshop series was, you know, it would be a shame if these kinds of philosophical questions were like only had in seminar rooms and lecture theatres, because this is really something that everyone can do. And especially when it comes to kind of philosophy of mind and the way that philosophy of mind can contribute to ideas around mental health, it makes sense that it's not just philosophers having these conversations. It's people with all sorts of backgrounds in mental health, whether that's people with lived experience of mental distress or other unusual beliefs and experiences, or people who perhaps have had some professional experience working in mental health contexts, or people who are mental health advocates, and you might identify as like more than one of those categories. The idea was that it feels like our philosophical efforts would be strengthened if we invited people with all these different experiences and backgrounds of mental health to do the philosophy of mental health. And that's really what we were trying to do with the workshop series.
Mm-hmm. My experience of the group was that it was such a diverse, interesting group. You asked everyone to write an application before, just to tell why they were interested in the group and whether they had any background in philosophy. I was wondering what your sense of who was interested in the group was from those applications.
I would say that maybe half or perhaps a third, something like that, were people who had some experience of philosophy previously, like whether that was in an academic setting or whether it was in like a peer-run group. So there were certainly people who kind of had done something similar to this before. But then maybe the other half or perhaps the other two-thirds were people who maybe had done philosophy in the sense that they'd perhaps kind of read some philosophy or they'd been kind of thinking personally about philosophical ideas, but who were just interested in kind of what they could bring and what they can learn.
Yeah. If you could just describe to me a little bit about the course, what was involved in each group and the kind of meta structure as well.
Yeah, so the way that the workshop series worked was that we ran 6 workshop sessions. I guess the first session looked at just introducing some core kind of philosophical ideas and concepts and techniques as well. So that group in particular looked at like what is it to argue and what is a philosophical argument. And I think it's really key. There's this idea that we discussed where there can be this really combative and kind of aggressive sense of argument, and that's not the sense we're interested in. We're interested in the sense where I guess you're just putting forward a position to an interlocutor, or, you know, just someone who you're going to have a discussion with, and you're going to, I guess, like, have an opportunity to kind of support your position and get feedback on your position. And that doesn't mean that you then have to change your mind. It's just, I guess, a way to air your views and yeah, I guess, engage in that kind of group setting where you're all discussing things together. And we kind of looked at some thought experiments as well. So that's where you, I guess, you kind of simulate a situation, or you're trying to imagine yourself in a situation and trying to imagine what it would be like. And then you can kind of use the results of those imaginings to kind of come to some philosophical conclusions. So that's the idea. That's how this is supposed to work. So that was the first week. And then over the next couple of weeks, we kind of looked at, I guess we focused on like a particular case of cognition for each week. So in the second week, we looked at the just the notion of experience. So how is it that we come to have experiences of the world? And one of the questions that we asked was, are we kind of just passively perceiving the world around us? Is that how perception works? Or is it the case that we're kind of adding something to the perceptual information that's incoming? So we're using our own ideas to interpret that perceptual information. So that was kind of the discussion in the second week. And then the third, fourth, and fifth weeks, we looked at beliefs and then reasoning, and then looking at, I guess, different ways to talk about mental health and experiences in mental health as a result of everything we discussed in the last couple of weeks. And then in the sixth week, we then turn to the notion of what is it to evaluate our cognitions? Like, is that, like, what would it look like if we kind of engaged in that, those sorts of discussions, and who should kind of get to do that? Yeah, so I guess that was kind of the shape of the course.
In terms of the relations between this group and classic peer support groups, what was your sense of that?
In many ways, it was very similar to what happens in a peer support group, because the idea is that the group sets up the values of the space, the group decides kind of how they want the space to be held. And I think that's all really valuable to ensure that everyone feels like they can contribute. But I think one thing that makes it potentially different is the notion that we've got this content that we're discussing, and we're using philosophical models to kind of explore the claims which are made. So on the one hand, it's really valuable. Those models are strengthened when we invite lived experience and when we invite experiences of different ways to engage in mental health and mental health discussions. And we use those to develop our models. But it doesn't necessitate sharing your experience if you don't feel ready to, or if you don't feel that week that's something you want to do, because we're often talking in the abstract. We're talking about greater models which connect our experiences. What are the things that connect them? What are the differences between them? What are the features that characterize them? And you can get involved in that discussion without necessarily sharing from personal experience. And another thing you can do is actually just learn from other people's experiences. You can choose to do that one week as well. So I think that would be one kind of difference, because we've got this specific content that we're kind of working with in the discussions.
There were so many different levels to the group, sometimes really quite emotional, people sharing their personal experience, and then also these very theoretical conversations. And then we also had examples. You brought some very interesting content, like the image of the dress that people disagreed whether it was blue and black or white and gold,
yeah.
And then optical illusions. I was wondering, how did you kind of compile such a rich course?
So actually, it's really funny just talking about bringing examples into the group. So personally, as an academic, I really thrive when I have a series of examples to understand complex concepts. And that's one thing I really strive to do in my academic work. And it's one thing that I get frustrated with when I'm engaging with other people and I don't see examples, because I find that's something that just really helps me to learn and to understand. And I'm not sure to what extent other people are like me in that respect, but I thought that it was really important for each session to have like a range of concrete examples so that people can engage in whatever level they like with the kind of theory around the examples, but everyone can get involved in an example that's just kind of there in front of them. So this is why I guess it's really nice to have things like optical illusions, things like the dress, which is this picture that like people on the internet got like, really excited about and generated a lot of discussion, for that reason that it brings everyone together on this one thing, this one example, and then we can kind of diverge from there and say, oh, this reminds me of this, or this helps me think about this other experience I had. And yeah, so I think it's a nice way into the discussion.
Another really important aspect of the group was the kind of radical feeling to it, and this idea, as you said, in the later weeks we talked about models of mental health, and a few of the group members that identified as survivors of the mental health system, there was a very important aspect to the space of questioning that. Was that something you expected from the group?
I felt like I tried to come with really very few expectations of kind of how the groups were going to be, because it was the first time that I'd been involved in something like this. I think it would be wrong to say that I wasn't expecting there to be passion and I wasn't expecting there to be disagreements, because we knew from the start that what we were doing was involving people who were going to have different perspectives and were going to have very valuable lived experience. That does mean that people are going to disagree on particular things. Mm. Again, I think this is why it's just really important that everyone is involved in discussing how they want to hold the space and what the values of the space are going to be, so that yes, you can go there, you can have those deep and often quite conflicting discussions, but you can come out of it at the end. We can all remain friends and we can agree that sometimes we're going to want to look at things in different ways. Although I have to say, my perspective on a lot of what came out of the group, we might have disagreed on some of the philosophical models, but I think there was some common sense of purpose, I would say, in what we were doing. That's maybe something I didn't anticipate, and that was really, really nice to come away from.
There was this real sense of purpose, and that it was a safe space where people agreed on a lot of things. I was wondering how that's inspired your work going forward, or this kind of engagement with non-academic worlds.
Sure, okay. In terms of going forwards, yeah, there is one thing I'm actually particularly engaged with one of the participants. We're co-writing a paper just about the value of doing philosophy in contexts outside of academia, and particularly in mental health spaces. And we're not making any bold claims there, other than really just to say that we think this is something that's valuable, from at least from a facilitator and a participant perspective. And you know, we'd really like this to be a paper that a whole variety of audiences read.
I was just wondering, is there anything else that you would like to say about the group or your experience?
You've asked me some really lovely questions and given me an opportunity to talk about like a load of stuff that's made me really happy. So I feel like this is it. Yeah, thank you.
Great. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you very much for coming. The second half of this podcast is a discussion with some of my fellow group participants about our experiences of the group, what was most important, what the group felt like, and what has stayed with us.
So perhaps we can all go around and introduce ourselves and maybe say what was your previous experience or perspective of philosophy, or alternatively, why you decided to participate in this workshop series.
My name is Ray Wilmot. I had studied some philosophy before, but I didn't know how it might relate to my experience both as a survivor of the mental health system and also as someone in what's called service user involvement, where you use your experience as a survivor to help other people who are either experiencing mental health issues or have come into contact with the mental health system, and helping them to get a better service from whoever it is treating them, and also helping them to understand their situation. And I had a hope that this course might help me to understand better what might be involved in that.
So my name is Bala. I was diagnosed with bipolar affective disorder, I think it was about 10 years ago now. And since then, I was very interested in trying to understand what was actually happening with my mind when I'm in that space, because the space of bipolar can be very, very low and very high, but to extreme levels. So reality was shifting through my perspective based on where I was in relation to the illness that I was suffering with at the time. So through my life experience, I started to then explore into Eastern philosophy. And I looked at the Vedic philosophy, which here over in the West is known as the Hare Krishnas. And coming to the course, it was interesting to see the difference between Western thought and application in relation to mental health and the mind. It's very biochemical. An Eastern tradition which looks at a more of a holistic way, but is perhaps a little cautious towards the allopathic approach. So I wanted to try to find a balance to be found amongst all different aspects of mental health, such as spiritual, emotional, physical, and also the mental aspect itself.
And my name's Pippa Sweeney. I have always been interested in mental health and understanding myself better and those around me. And I guess that's one of the reasons that led me to train in clinical psychology. So I'm now a clinical psychologist. And I think participating in this workshop, it came just at the right time for me. I'd just dropped down to 4 days, which is 4 days working per week. And that was an incredible opportunity, really, for me to have a day a week, really, to explore other ways of working in the area of mental health and being of use to people in distress and finding ways to keep my mind open, as working inside mental health services can sometimes feel a bit overpowering and overwhelming sometimes in terms of the lack of thinking that you get to do and the strong ideas there are that dominate the services we exist in. So yeah, that was one of the key reasons that I wanted to participate, and I was very excited to be able to join.
It's so nice to see all of you again. So I was wondering if we could together kind of talk a bit about what it was like the first couple of groups. Does anyone have any first impressions?
I was surprised by a couple of things, really. One was how open it was right from the start to your own experiences and views, even though there was a formal taught basis to the course. It was right from the word go very open in terms of having the chance to express your opinion and even to question Sophie's presentation. And I felt that she put a lot of skill and effort and forethought even into creating a situation that was just like that. And the other thing that impressed me very much was how open all the participants were to sharing their views and talking about themselves and disclosing experiences. And those two things together made, I thought, for a very positive atmosphere.
And it almost didn't take much for that discussion to get going. And as Ray was saying, there's just very, very open discussions and different points of views and perspectives. And even with the content being delivered by Sophie, which in itself, I think much of it was meant to prompt thinking and discussion points.
How many people were there? Can you remember?
I think there were 10 in each group.
About 10.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because there was two groups, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were two groups, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. So I think ours had 10 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing I noticed was, as I was expressing, I'm very much steeped in Eastern tradition, and I noticed that people who have had some experience with mental health diagnosis in some way tend to somehow or another lean towards Eastern philosophy without perhaps knowing that's what it is when they express it. But many of the people that were on the course would express things like, well, the mind is not my identity, and or the body is not the self, and it's a very esoteric understanding of reality and perception. And it was interesting to see that, because that's been my experience through mental health, through my time in being in sectioned twice and being in a mental health institution. Many of the people there speak in ways which would be seen as, I'm using air quotes, crazy by Western understanding, because their understanding of reality is different than the majority of the people over here in the West. But if they were to express these ideas and thoughts in an Eastern culture, nobody would even think anything of it, because it would be seen as completely different in context.
Yeah, so one of the main themes that we talked about in quite a lot of the discussions was how experiences and beliefs are classified as normal and abnormal, looking at what claims that distinction is based on, and then some of the research that refutes those claims. For instance, the idea that only abnormal people have delusions. We then looked at all the delusions that occur in all people.
Just remembering how much that prompted us to think, well, many of us to think about the dominant model within mental health services and the dominant model of understanding mental distress, and the problems that it highlights when we were looking at the philosophical tools were helping us to actually critique and find holes and problems actually within the mental health system and within the way of categorising and understanding mental distress. It seemed to bring up lots of emotion, because I think some of us felt that was really almost hypocritical for some people to categorise some certain types of thinking as signs of a mental disease, yet in their own making of those decisions or observations, they too would be making cognitive errors and using cognitive biases and bringing their own experiences and cognitive processes into that. So, yeah, it did lead to some very, I think, helpful discussions around the problems that exist in mental health services and the way that we understand the dominant kind of models for understanding distress.
Sophie called it the naive model of mental health. Yep. Do you guys remember that? It was the model that we critique, the idea that there are normal and abnormal experiences and beliefs, and that abnormal ones are necessarily bad, and they're bad both psychologically because they make you feel bad, and epistemically because they mean you have less knowledge about the world. That's the mainstream model. And so then a lot of our conversations were tackling those claims individually. First of all, can you make this distinction between normal and abnormal? Second of all, is it true that the things called abnormal and experienced negatively? We sort of saw through both research and people's experiences that there's not grounds to make those claims in such a strong way.
More nuanced than black and white.
I don't know if people agree or feel that. I feel like we found that quite easy to critique that naive model. It felt quite obvious to everyone in the room that naive model just didn't work. Mm. And I guess the point that hits home for me a lot is how much I still see that as a clinician in mental health services, and how much I still feel like I have to be helping people to think about other ways of understanding mental health and their experiences, rather than this only model that seems to exist in much of the discussions, the dominance of that. It means that there's not so much kind of challenging of that naive model, in my experience.
I very much agree with that. It's interesting that in mental health, psychiatrists and clinicians use the word insight, and what that means is that if you accept their model of your so-called illness, that means that you have insight into your condition, and if you don't accept it, then that means that you don't have insight. But it's an interesting word to use, because insight suggests a kind of depth of understanding of your own experience, and in actual fact that's not how the word is actually meant when, say, a psychiatrist uses it. They mean that you just simply take on board the dominant view in society, and that is supposed to be insight.
Mm-hmm. As you're speaking there, I remember one of the challenges that I had was that I would sometimes speak from a position of maybe devil's advocate, but also not exactly that, defending the system in places, not completely. Because if I speak generally and I say psychiatrists are like this, it's almost like the same as them when they say mental health people are like this. So I am trying to not be in the same position by just categorizing these as a particular type of people, because my personal experience with them has sometimes been very open. My recent psychiatrist is also very open to my understanding of philosophy in relation to multiple lives, reincarnation, and karma. So I could openly talk about these things, which are unusual beliefs, with my psychiatrist without her telling me, well, I think we need to watch that. Because she trusted me to be able to know when to monitor my own limits.
I want to agree with the idea that not all mental health professionals share what we've described as this dominant point of view. On the one hand, many of the participants on this course were in one way or another mental health professionals, just like Pippa. And it also the trust that I happen to do service user involvement for has shown very willing to look at different ways of treating people and is actually piloting such a scheme right now, which involves much more listening to what the service user or patient's experience is and what their point of view is, and really trying to engage with it.
In that relation, I did wonder, one of the things that I was concerned about leaning too far towards that direction is validating an experience which is harmful. So if somebody is hearing voices and I agree with that person, oh yeah, that's a real thing, it's kind of facilitating something that might not actually be helpful. How much am I going to say encourage something which is actually a delusion of some kind? So am I going to encourage a delusion for somebody in order to help them to get better? What's helping them to get better? So for me, it's again coming back to that point of balance.
I think what I feel is that when someone expresses what to most people is a delusion, it's one thing to say that, oh, this is happening simply because of there's a fault with the chemistry of your brain. As opposed to saying, well, this is a sign that something that you're in some kind of distress or there is some conflict going on inside you, and let's try and explore what that conflict is. And rather than just saying, well, this is merely something to do with your body chemistry and we'll just shut it down as by whatever means, chemical generally, rather than trying to explore what is being said, what kind of, if the person, say, feels persecuted or if they feel that they're being obliged to do something that they'd actually not want to do, to try and explore what exactly is that about, what is actually, what might be going on inside that person and what might be going on for them, and to try to explore that. And that's an alternative way to the dominant way. I think that's really the issue.
I think that's reminded me of a couple of the stories that Sophie shared. I think they're in Lisa Bortolotti, who's the project lead of Project Perfect. They're in her TED Talk, the stories of Jamie and Leela. Do you guys remember them?
Mm-hmm. Was it Jamie was having experiences of hearing voices, and he, I think, had some problems with his neighbours, and he came to the conclusion that they were spies, and that they were that actually, once they knew that he had realised this, that they were likely to harm him. And I think one of the examples was that could be argued that there was unhelpful elements to that conclusion, because it led him to kind of break into his neighbour's apartment and remove any items that could have been used as weapons. And I remember part of that example was actually then thinking about the context of those beliefs, and actually understanding more of Jamie's background helped you to understand that he had come to understandably form a belief that people were largely hostile and harmful, and that actually he was trying to make sense of why he was hearing voices, and the conclusion that he came to was actually as valid as any other beliefs in many ways. But we're thinking about how helpful those beliefs might be rather than whether they're true or not.
Yeah, I think we were thinking, how could those beliefs be positive in some ways? Mm-hmm. And we talked about, in some ways, being able to tell a story that makes sense of your situation mm-hmm. can be really reassuring if you don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's also a way of communicating what you're feeling.
Absolutely.
Like if you're feeling like your neighbours are going to attack you, that's communicating that you're scared.
Mm-hmm.
I think in that story, maybe even Jamie had been attacked by mm-hmm. someone or mugged by someone recently.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that made me think of what you were saying, Ray, about understanding a bit more about the person's experience and asking about the experience, then you can understand a bit more about why their belief is there, and that belief can communicate things to you about them. Is that what you...
Yes, and that I think what one thing about that is that it involves a different way of working, and it involves for a mental health professional both a respect for their patient or their client, and also a willingness to give them time to talk, and that those kind of things go right back to basic working practice and if you like the culture of the system, and it's really about asking questions about whether the whole way our mental health system is set up, whether that is the best way for it to be.
On that same point of is it helpful or not, having had experiences with a full manic stage of bipolar, I know for myself that the reality that I was experiencing at that time, parts of it were helpful and beautiful and euphoric. Other parts of it were incredibly dangerous for myself and other people. So I would feel that if I had a mental health support worker that was willing to understand and listen to me as I'm talking about my experience, I'd be very happy. However, I would be very cautious if there was a mental health practitioner that was validating that dangerous experience. And if then they're saying, oh, nothing's wrong, it's just an experience, almost like saying there's no such thing as a mental health illness, which we've fought so hard to try to get validity for something that is actually an illness. It's actually something that is a valid illness. And then moving into a direction which is like, it's just an experience.
Mm.
For me, it feels a little bit like, wait a minute.
Mm. I think that's one of the interesting things about the group was we had such a range of different perspectives on mental health and whether it should even be called mental health or whether there were other models like powerlessness. Yeah, all different
viewing it as a social. I remember that the idea
systemic.
But I remember the idea that when the NHS was first formed, it was being decided whether issues of the mind should be addressed in social care or as a health issue, and almost that being decided that it fit best within the kind of model of health.
One of the things I'm reminded of in the first week, we learned some philosophical tools, and one of the things we learned was the root of argument, the word meaning. So we were ask what does argument mean, and everyone said like, oh well, hostile, shouting, like fight. And then we learned a bit about the etymology of argument, and it means to make clear or to make bright.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of our arguments where people had really different perspectives on things like mental illness, whether it exists or not, even though we didn't agree, we were able to kind of examine our own beliefs and mm-hmm. in relation to each other. That was something I really valued about the group.
Yeah,
I think that is something that can apply in someone's practice, both from someone like myself doing service user involvement, and also for someone who's a mental health professional. And I think there is actually a term which is reflective practice, which is kind of being seen as a good way of working, part of, if you like, a best practice in general for people in the mental health field. And reflective practice involves, in a way, not just being satisfied with everything that you've done, but thinking about it and trying to decide, let's say, whether you made a good decision and could you make a better one next time, and also in terms of how that your experience of working is affecting you, and is it, if you like, causing you distress, or is it giving you satisfaction, and why that might be. And for me, this course has encouraged the idea that this sort of reflective practice is a worthwhile thing, and it's not even about having any specific conclusions or like there's a specific point of view that you're getting at. It's very much connected with your own personal process and whatever that might be at any given time that you if you like become aware of it. You tune into what is going on for you and how you might develop as both as a person and as a professional.
Yeah, I think for me, since the course, what we talked a bit about, like humility, and that being something you develop through learning about others' experiences and also learning how partial your view of reality is. And so for me, realizing that has made me think more, I think, not constantly, and it's obviously something you have to keep working on, but how is my view only partial, and what other views might be there in that kind of reflective way that you mentioned?
Absolutely. I feel that I'm doing that almost, yeah, all the time, and it can be incredibly tiring and energy using, but it's so important to be constantly reflecting, as you said, Ray, but also questioning what I think and just reminding myself that, you know, my beliefs are just that's just my perspective and my way of making sense of the world, and always being as wary as I can that I'm never trying to impose that on someone else, but perhaps sharing it with them, but being tentative in sharing that and saying this is just one way, you know, and I could be completely wrong, and no, there's no wrong and right, actually. It's just one option for kind of understanding or making sense. And in doing so, yeah, in a tentative way, I always try my best to be aware of that, actually I don't know. But this is just my way of guessing, and I'm trying to make sense of something.
Do you think that's kind of what philosophy is? Before I did this group, I thought philosophy was kind of like learning about Aristotle and things like that. Whereas since doing it,
right.
I think one of the biggest values of the group was we did philosophy together, and I'd never thought of it as something that you could do together as a group, like as a discussion. Okay. But now that's kind of what I think of it. And so I was wondering what you guys think about the term philosophy and what we did.
Well, from my perspective, for us, for the Hare Krishnas, this group philosophy thing, like, they have meetings, I mean, in India, it would be every day. You would just sit and people would discuss philosophy. That's pretty much all they do
mm-hmm.
with each other, and then also...
So can I interrupt and say, how do you think what we were doing in our philosophy of mind group... relate, like, do you think it's the same kind of philosophy or different?
It's different, but it's still an opportunity. Still, it felt normal to me, and mm-hmm. that's what I mean. It felt like, yeah, this is what humans do.
Yeah,
because life, existence, and meaning is important.
Mm-hmm.
What is an identity? Everything in philosophy has elements of social, psychology, identity. So, for me, it's abnormal to not talk about it. Even when I was not a Hare Krishna, when I was drinking in the pub, I would always be talking about these things, and people would be just like, can't we just have fun in the pub? Like, no, let's talk about this really deep subject matter. So, yeah, it's nice to have to have that. It feels kind of normal to connect and talk about these things.
I think people spontaneously do want to talk about what you've called this deep subject matter, but don't always feel very well equipped to do so. And one thing I feel the course has given me is some of the tools to think about these deep going questions.
So I was thinking maybe if we could each think of one moment or thing that stood out from the course and just describe it quickly and like why that stands out to you.
For me, one standout moment wasn't actually so much about ideas, it was about feelings. And what it was, we were all having a discussion, and that there was this moment when it seemed like as if there was an emotional unity to the group. And it wasn't that necessarily that everyone agreed with everyone else, but that there was a kind of way that the things that were being expressed by different people seemed to go together in some kind of deep way. And it was almost like hearing a piece of music, but it was a question of the emotional feel that was coming from being in that group. And that is something I really treasure.
On a similar note, one of the most memorable parts for me actually was when we all came together at the end of the series, and most of us were able to come to an additional kind of meeting where different people brought different ways of presenting some of the ideas that had touched them the most, or poetry and readings and presentations, just short, but it was a fantastic day that for me it was leading on from what you were saying, Ray, was just that everyone coming together and having their own part to play in the group, and I left feeling, you know, incredibly inspired by everyone, and just the variety and the richness of the ideas and the experiences that were coming out of that kind of collective meeting. So I really appreciated that.
So I'm going to preempt this with a little something about my understanding of me and philosophy. So from our perspective, from the Vedic understanding, every living entity is three things. It's Sat, Sit, and Ananda, which means we're eternal, we're full of knowledge, and we're full of bliss. And these are all unlimited and increasing at every moment. That's our actual nature. So for me, in the philosophy group, although there were many different I like to call them external ideas, like different takes on perspective of certain things. For me, the fundamental underlying thing that was powerful was actually the sameness, is the fundamentalness of that, for me, the nature of the soul, given space to express itself, hearing these threads, the threads of that foundation of this, from my perspective, this beautiful existence that has nothing to do with anything in this material realm, to hear that being expressed through these other vibrant beings was really, it's powerful to hear this thread of connectedness.
Yeah, I think the feeling at the end of the course was that we really all had been on quite a journey together, and for me, it was such a privilege to be able to talk about really important things with all of you. Mm. Yeah, and it's nice to do it again now.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
It's actually the same length of time we would have.
Same length, yeah. Actually, we should probably stop.
We had an hour.
I'm not really sure how to wrap it up. Does anyone have any last thoughts?
Just on that idea of journey, that word is sticking out for me, that I feel like I'm on, you know, a journey with, I don't know, what I'm doing in my life and my professional life, and yeah, I feel like this workshop series and meeting you all and being part of it is part of that journey, and then there's lots of other things that are part of that journey, and it feels great to come back, like you say, and be reminded of this part and being reconnected to it. So some fantastic ideas.
And I guess for any listeners who want to look at some of this material, Sophie's kindly made it all available, and she's even made facilitator notes. So if you feel like running your own philosophy group, all of the information's there on the internet, and you just need a few people. They don't have to have anything in common, just be willing to talk to each other. Thanks everyone for coming on a rainy Saturday. Really good to see all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
To download the Philosophy of Mind workshop series materials, go to the Project Perfect website, which is in the show notes of this episode. To read more about Sophie and her colleagues' work, go to their blog, imperfectcognitions.blogspot.com. And the TED Talk that I mentioned is called Three Stigmas About Mental Health We Need to Deconstruct, and you can find that on YouTube. To find out about other courses and groups at Mind in Camden, go to www.mindincamden.org.uk.
You are listening to a podcast from Camden Community Radio.
www.ccradio.org.